Hello, and welcome to the Heritage Radio Network. This is the premiere episode of our newly founded Heritage How To section. And the music that you're listening to below my voice is by My Sister in 1994, which features Ben England on drums, one of the masterminds behind Roberta's bread baking project, the much talked about, soon to be very famous bread baking project. And with us today we have a very special guest, bread enthusiast, bread maverick, Dick Bessie, and he's basically going to tell our listeners start to finish how to bake your bread to a quality that should be on par with Roberta's. Dick has been baking bread his entire life. He's built the pizza oven here at Roberta's. He's in the process of building another oven that's going to be dedicated solely to the bread project. And we can't possibly think of a better person to anchor our first Heritage How-To than the master of the do-it-yourself, Dick Bessie. Dick, why don't you say hello to our listeners?
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Lorenzo. I actually have to correct one small thing. I actually did not build the pizza oven itself. That got put on a plane or a boat and dragged over here and dropped in one piece. But indeed, we are going to build a very large bread dedicated oven in the back of Roberta's in the next month or so. So all that bread that people are getting either here at the restaurant or over on Bedford on Saturdays is going to be available here in much larger quantities with a lot of different kinds of breads available. So
are you guys going to be selling the bread on Bedford at a market or something?
There is every Saturday morning they're doing bread sales now, in fact, or Saturday afternoon, I think about 1 o'clock down on Bedford around 7th.
Hmm.
And it's not a large number of loaves. They have a limited production capability right now simply because the pizza oven doesn't bake that much bread that well. And Ben has to be done with what he's doing before pizza service starts. So we're kind of limited by capacity. But as soon as the big oven gets put in place again sometime in July, we'll have a lot higher capacity.
Well, I can tell our listeners that I'm really excited about this show. What we've got here basically is a mix of Roberta's music and Roberta's bread making expertise. The band My Sister in 1984, like I said, the drummer is essentially the assistant to Dick's bread baking operation. Dick is basically going to tell you, he's going to give you a step-by-step guide from ingredients to tools to techniques to results of how to bake bread on a caliber with the bread being baked here at Roberta, which has been mentioned in the Times, which has been mentioned on Tasting Table. And I just want to start off, Dick. Your daughter told me a really interesting story about how you got into bread baking, and I just don't think it's fair for our listeners to hear a whole how-to about bread from you without hearing this story first.
Well, I think that it was more a matter of survival. I got involved in baking bread and cooking when I was in college. I lived with three other guys who really had no interest in food necessarily, and I made a deal with them finally that if they washed dishes, I would cook and I would bake and we would all maybe survive. And that's how that got started. So that was a lot longer ago than I care to admit. I've actually been doing this, as I say, casually for close to 40 years and commercially for around 4. So Roberta's has been a great opportunity to try and get my bread making skills down, see if I can pass this along to somebody else. And Ben's done one hell of a job, frankly. The bread in my, I'm not necessarily here every day, and Ben carries on very, very well. So we've got a good program going, and I suppose that I owe that in some part to these three clowns that I live with in college who we either, you know, eat or die.
So it was a craft forged in the furnace of necessity?
More or less, yeah. And they didn't wash that many dishes either. We would wind up with great huge piles of dishes.
So you fed them, but no dishwashers.
That's right. That's right.
Well, here on Heritage Radio Network, this series of how-tos is going to be sort of the voice of America's artisanal movement. And I think that sometimes circumstances like the one in which you found yourself forge and breed the best artisans in our country. Necessity, curiosity, and a dedication to make the best product you can. So I can't think of a better a better first show. So tell me, do you want to get into ingredients? Is there anything that the basic do-it-yourself home bread maker should know before they even set out to tackle this project?
I think that there's this sort of cliche of buying the best ingredients that you can afford. I think that if you're looking, for instance, the breads that we do here are flour, salt, and water. The bread right now is has no commercial yeast in it, and so we have a sourdough culture that I've had for on the order of 15 years that we moved out here and works very, very well. And in a little bit, we can talk about how to make your own sourdough culture. People who want to buy flour, there are a couple or three brands. I don't want to sound like an advertisement, so if I mention a specific brand, it's just that it's because it's one that I've used for a while and I'm quite happy with.
Sure.
There is a place in Vermont called King Arthur Flour that makes really, really good flour. And one of the major things that's good about their flour is that they don't bleach it. You wind up with this nice sort of creamy color to the flour, and the same color gets imparted to your bread. And whether you use their unbleached flour or somebody else's, you want to make sure that that stuff is left in there. If you have really bright white flour that's been bleached, a lot of the flavor goes away. That's just one of the byproducts or the effects, unfortunately, of bleaching flour. Salt.
Why do they bleach flour?
If you go back hundreds and hundreds of years, when flour was first being refined, you get lighter colored flour by getting finer and finer grains. And when the flours of old were separated out, the people who could really afford to have white flour or light-colored bread had that, and they were the rich folks. People who were unable to afford this highly refined stuff were relegated to darker flour, whole, you know, sort of whole grain flour, all the stuff that we like to think of as healthy right now, right? And if you were a, like I say, if you were in the nobility or you had a lot of money, you could afford to buy white flour and make nice light-colored bread. And that sort of segued into the current thought of just bleaching it, making it bright white. You wouldn't have any color at all, and, you know, the whiter the better kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically, before we get into our conversation about the ingredients proper, the first of which is obviously flour, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the slow food movement and how you became friends with Patrick Martins, who is the person to whom we owe this radio studio, essentially.
I have been a member of Slow Food since the mid-90s when we lived in North Carolina, and moved to New York the first part of 99, became more aware at that point that the U.S. office was here in New York. And I'm not a bread baker by original profession. I'm a telecommunications person who happened to be involved in a small company which sort of drove off a cliff. And I had some time where I could try and get in touch with Patrick. I volunteered at the office for a length of time, and then for almost 2 years I actually worked on salary for the national office. And Patrick left Slow Food, started Heritage Foods USA. He and I have kept in contact, and he called me last year and asked if I might be interested in working a bread project with Roberta's. They were looking at doing something beyond the pizza that they're doing. And I came out, met the folks that were here, and one thing led to another. We started the bread program using the current pizza oven, and then started the project of building the bread oven back here this summer.
Yeah, I must say, if there's one thing that Patrick's good at, it's enmeshing the various talents of the people that surround him and putting them together.
Absolutely. I would not have found this arrangement had it not been for Patrick. And I don't know that they would have the bread program that they do had Patrick not dragged me into the picture. So it's been a win-win for everybody.
Great. Well, we are going to go to a full track by my sister in 1994. And then we're going to come back with Dick, and he's going to talk about ingredients. And you should get your notepad ready because he's about to impart some serious secrets about delicious bread. Heritage Radio Network. That was My Sister in 1994. And we are here with Dick Bessie, who's going to give us a little how-to and general knowledge session on bread. So, Dick, we were talking before the break about ingredients, and you were telling me during the segment break that the ingredient combinations aren't that complex.
That's right.
How do you go about baking your bread? How do you think an amateur bread maker should go about doing it themselves on, say, a test size of 2 loaves, 3 loaves? Tell me what kind of different ingredients there are and which you choose and which you don't choose and why.
Okay. The bread that I bake at home, I use ingredients that are almost precisely the same as the ingredients we use here. We buy, again, no necessary endorsement, although I really like their product. We buy King Arthur flour in 50-pound bags. you can go to your local grocery store and buy that same flour. Their general purpose flour is a great bread flour in 5 pound bags for what, $5 or something like that. Okay. And bread is actually, those kinds of pure wheat breads are pretty simple. You've got wheat flour, some salt, some water, and some form of yeast. I like using a kosher salt, something like that, the non-iodized stuff. It has a nice bright flavor to it. There's no extras. Any salt that has an additive so that it flows, even though things are kind of damp, doesn't taste quite the same. And you'll find bakeries that use very, very expensive sea salts, and they, if you are really paying attention, you may be able to tell some difference in flavor. But most people, including me, unless I'm just somebody said this is what you should be tasting, plain kosher salt, something like that, will work just fine. Tap water in New York City is phenomenally clean tasting. There's no issue there. If you have really terrible water in your water system, then bottled water may make a great deal of difference, just because if you've got really off flavors in your water, it'll show up as off flavors in your bread.
It's not just a myth about the water being why the pizza is good in New York?
No, probably not. And, you know, there are a lot of restaurants in New York that are quite happy to sell you uncarbonated bottled water, but you get flavor just as good by Mayor Bloomberg's finest, and the stuff tastes just fine. So those three ingredients, we use a sourdough starter here, I think I mentioned, is something that I started 15, 20 years ago and have brought with me to New York. And you just keep rebuilding that from session to session, and it provides the wild yeast that you need for the bread that we do. If you want to use that kind of a starter, in a little bit we can talk about how to make a starter for your own purposes. If you want to use commercial yeast, there are what are called instant yeasts that are dry, that give really good performance, if you pay some attention to using a little bit less than a recipe might call for, then you can get a bready kind of flavor as opposed to a yeasty kind of flavor in your breads, and you can still make really decent bread with just those four things: flour, salt, water, and yeast of some kind.
Okay, so say I want to make a couple loaves at home.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You've told me the basic ingredients. You've talked about a yeast starter, which to me is like reading Braille. I have no idea what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to me. I've got these ingredients in front of me. What do I do?
I'm not sure quite how to answer that question, because I sort of do that with my eyes closed at this point. If you are starting, let's say for instance you want to do what we call a straight dough, which is a.
Am I oversimplifying it? Is that why you're?
No, not at all. The straight doughs have commercial yeast in them. You basically start with flour and water and mix those together and throw the instant yeast on. And mix all that together, and then mix in the salt, and then you can start the proofing, the sort of, you know, let it rise, like the cookbooks say, let it rise two times and then punch it down. Punching is such a brutal word to use on dough.
Uh-huh.
But the act of mixing for bread, I think a lot of people think, oh, I've got to put it in my countertop mixer, or I have to just beat it within an inch of its life in order to make it come together. What you're trying to do is get what we call some structure, some gluten. You want it to come together so that all of those strands of gluten in the dough hold together, and it will trap the carbon dioxide and so on that comes off of the fermentation from the yeast and allows the bread to rise.
Okay, and how do you tell when it's reached that state?
If you are... just to sort of to start from the very beginning, if you want to start from the very beginning, you'd mix all of those things together, and I don't like to use a lot of mixing. I do what we call folding dough. So you basically pull everything together so that it's in, you know, either with a mixer. Here we got a couple of large mixers because we're doing 20 or 30 kilograms of dough at a time, which is a little difficult to do by hand. But if you're just going to do a couple loaves of bread, you would do it in a bowl by hand, and then just cover that with plastic wrap. Let it sit for, say, 45 minutes or an hour. Come back and then dig your hands underneath the dough and fold it back on top of itself, sort of
repeatedly.
Repeatedly. Turn the bowl 90 degrees, fold it back on top of itself, and turn it again and fold it back on top of itself. And you can do this like an hour after you've mixed things together, and then come back and do it again another 45 minutes or an hour. And the dough, as you'll be able to tell as you're doing this, that the dough begins to get a lot stronger. You can feel it becoming more elastic as you are doing these folds. And once you have gone through a couple of these, you can let it rest for a little bit, dump it out of the bowl onto your countertop with some flour, and then cut it into the, like you've got measured out enough flour and what have you to do two loaves, cut it in half. Shape them the way you want them and cover it back up with plastic, and again let it rise back to a maybe half again as much or twice as big, and then you can stick it in the oven. And when we get to tools, we can talk about things like pizza stones and temperatures and what mm-hmm. have you, but what you're going to do is basically put it in the oven, let it bake, and then you're done. So that in a nutshell is what you're doing. We don't do a whole lot different here, except that instead of a couple loaves, we do anywhere from a dozen or 15 to 45 or 50 at a crack. And when we get the big oven built and back, we'll be running 300-400 loaves a day, which is actually a fairly small amount of bread. There is a baker that I'm acquainted with on the Upper East Side in Manhattan who runs through 70,000 pounds of flour a week. So
it's a lot of bread.
Yeah. But all of these things can be scaled. He uses the same kinds of formulas and the same kinds of techniques. He just does it in huge, huge quantities.
Sure. So the quantity doesn't necessarily change the technique. Everything just has to come sort of in concert. All the ingredients have to increase or decrease.
That's correct.
So now that we're on the topic of 70,000 pounds of flour, if I'm trying to make, say, a loaf that will serve two, mm-hmm. I mean, I know loaves themselves don't serve, but that will serve as an accompaniment to a meal mm-hmm. that's about the size of a Roberta's loaf, what kind of measurements would I want to be using? How much water? How much flour? What kind of a mix are we talking about here? I know you're a perfectionist when it comes to these things. So you endorse the weighing technique?
I do. There are large numbers of recipes or formulas for home bakers that are set forth in, you know, so many cups of flour, so many cups of water, a couple teaspoons of yeast and a couple teaspoons or a tablespoon or whatever of salt. And the difficulty there is that a cup of water weighs pretty much the same as the next cup of water, depending on how precisely you measure the cup. A cup of flour, however, can vary wildly in how much it weighs, depending on whether you compress it in the cup or it's
how finely,
yeah, it's finely ground, or how fluffy it is when you dump it in there. There's been a large body of, if you will, volume recipes where they talk about, you know, sift the flour and then put it in a cup level and scrape it off with a knife. But you find that for the investment of, say, $30 or $35 or $40 for a scale, you can then work with measurements in weight for a loaf, for instance, that we do here that weighs 750 grams when it goes into the oven. You'll have on the order of total maybe 400 and some grams of flour and 300 and some grams of water.
And, what about the salt?
And then the salt is – and I do these things in percentages, so I'm having to do some conversions in my head.
Okay.
There's a thing that is known in the business, if you will, as baker's math.
Okay.
Where you start with the flour is always expressed as 100% as a number. And you'll hear people talk about 60% hydration loaves, which means that for every 100 grams of flour, there's 60 grams of water. And if
what kind of percentage hydration do you do?
We're doing 65% here.
65%.
And that's because we are doing them because of the limitations we have with the oven. Currently, we're making the loaves in the afternoon and sticking them in a cooler overnight. And if you put much more water into the loaf and then retard it, as it's called, overnight, you wind up with really funny performance in the morning. You feel like you've got this basket of Jell-O when you're trying to put the thing into the oven. When we're doing with the big oven this summer and we are no longer retarding loaves, we'll probably push it back up to 68 or 69%. And that only 2 or 3 or 4% difference in water makes a huge difference in the texture of the loaf and a huge difference overall in the flavor.
So even someone making the bread at home is going to have to let it sit for a period of time. Should
Absolutely.
They be using a smaller percentage?
Not necessarily. The problem with higher percentages of hydration is that the stuff gets kind of floppy and it's harder to handle.
Okay.
The average loaf that you come up with using the volume measurements at home is probably in the 55 to 60%, maybe a little higher range, because you get something that's actually got a fair amount of body to it when you finally turn it out onto a board and shape the thing. We've got loaves that are a lot looser than that. I think that when Ben first started doing this, he was absolutely appalled at how floppy the loaf was when he stuck it out on the bench. And it's a sort of thing that wetter doughs tend to get more interesting textures and flavors to them, but they're a little harder to handle.
Okay.
One of the breads that we'll do this summer that I have worked with before that we just don't get a chance to do here is 100% hydration whole wheat loaf. So I've got a kilogram of whole wheat flour and a kilogram of water, and it's very much like handling something like sloppy Jell-O. But the bread that you get has an absolutely amazing flavor to it and goes well with the sort of red wine and stinky cheese ethic, if you will, that comes out of Carlo's kitchen.
Okay, so I've got the bread. I mean, I've got the dough. Mm-hmm. I've hand-folded it.
Right?
Is that the correct technical term? And now, sort of, I've got it at the right texture, which is, how do I distinguish the right texture again?
If you're sort of doing this by hand, you develop, after a while, a feel for the bread having a sort of a springiness to it. And, you know, it's... I can hear somebody is listening to this thing later going, what the hell is he talking about? How do I tell what that's like? And it's very hard to describe and very easy to feel once you've done it a couple of times. If the bread or if the dough feels like it is way too sloppy and it doesn't, you know, when you pull it up to fold it, it feels like it's tearing and kind of bodiless, then wait and give it another fold. It should actually you should actually feel almost like it's fighting back a little bit.
Okay.
And when you then shape this thing into a loaf and put it into the kind of baskets that we do, once it's sat in the basket for like an hour or so at room temperature, then you can sort of push it with your finger, and if it's ready, the little dent that you put in with your finger will come back out only very, very slowly.
Okay.
And at that point you can
like a Tempur-Pedic mattress.
Yeah, almost. And at that point you can go ahead and put the thing into the oven.
Okay, so talk to me about yeast. What role does it play, and at what point do you add it? And it's very delicate, live. ingredient?
As long as we're going to talk about sequencing, we should talk about what happens when you're doing, when you're mixing all this stuff together. One technique that I like to use and a lot of professionals use, and it really costs you nothing except time at home, is called an autolyse, where you take the flour that you're going to use and the water that you're going to use, and you just dump them into a bowl and mix them together until the thing comes together in this sort of shaggy mass of stuff. Put a cover on it and walk away from it for about a half hour.
What's the mixture on that, the measurement?
Well, it depends on, if we were doing...
By the way, folks, this is Ben England, the drummer from My Sister in 1994.
And Ben Engel, sorry.
If you're going to be doing a Levain-type loaf or a sourdough-type loaf the way we do it here at Roberta's, that would be, the 100% flour and the 65% water. You just take the water and the flour. You don't want to have any yeast action going on there. So you just mix those two together and just let them sit.
All right.
And if you do this at home sometime, we're going to assume you've got the scale, right?
Scales on the counter.
Take the scale on the counter. Take 100 grams of water or 100 grams of flour and, let's say, 65 grams of water in a large measuring cup and just mash them together and mix it up so it's mixed thoroughly together, and you will find that it's got a real sort of tough consistency
pasty
to it.
Feel.
It's not even pasty. It feels like it'll tear if you grab it and pull on it. And then just take some plastic wrap and cover that cup and walk away from it and come back in about a half hour, and you'll find that now you have a much softer mass of dough and you can pull it. It's much more what we call extensible. It's almost elastic. And what that does is get the flour and water conditioned to where you can now mix in the salt and the yeast, and if you're using the sourdough starter like we do here, you can mix all that together, and your dough is going to come together a lot more successfully and a lot more easily than if you were to just mix it all together and let it go all at once.
What's going on during that period that you're letting it sit? I mean, is the water getting absorbed
by the flour? All the starches are beginning to break down. And, I'm not a chemist, and I should probably be a little better able to describe exactly
you
what's going on.
You just have a feel
on.
For
it's, yeah, you're, God knows, I read enough, I should remember some of this stuff, right? But what you're watching is the starches are starting to break down. The water is beginning to react with the dissolvable parts in the flour, and what you get is a lot less work that you have to do. Remember, from 6,000 years ago, when somebody discovered that if you leave a bunch of dough out overnight, it'll accidentally absorb yeast and start to rise on its own, to maybe 150 years ago, they didn't have mechanical mixers. Mm-hmm. All this stuff was done by hand. And as soon as they invented mechanical mixers, the next thing they did was to just beat the dough to death. And there has been a movement away from this, at least at the artisanal level, and up to fairly medium to large size bakeries where they pay attention to these kinds of things. What they want to do is not beat the dough to death. They would like to just pull the ingredients together enough that they can then let the dough sort of do what it needs to do. A couple of years ago, there is a column in the New York Times, in the dining section. Mark Bittman writes a thing called The Minimalist. And about 2.5 years ago, he did an article about Jim Leahy, who used to own Sullivan Street Bakery. Doing a bread that required no kneading whatsoever, no folds, no nothing.
Huh.
And his deal was to use a very tiny amount of yeast and a reasonably high hydration dough, mix the whole thing together, put a cover on the dough, and walk away from it for like 18 hours, no folds, nada, just then come back and mold it and bake it. And if you leave dough alone long enough, the gluten sort of forms naturally without any folding, without any extra work being done on it. But you certainly don't have to, the way the old cookbooks say, dump it out onto a board and knead it into submission. All of the so-called kneading that we do here is in those two or three folds before we shape the loaves and we divide them and shape them and put them in the baskets and then run them into the oven.
So basically, just to wrap up our ingredients section here, how much yeast do you add per loaf, if you could break it down that way?
If you are doing a non-sourdough loaf, just to sort of have it roughly the same kind of texture that we have here, you'd use I'll do it in percentages and then we'll break it down into some numbers. Basically 100% flour, 65% water, about 2 or 2.5% salt and 1% yeast. So if you've got 1,000 grams of flour and 650 grams of water, you now have enough to make a couple or three good sized loaves, and you would add a couple hundred grams of salt, or 20 grams of salt and about 10 grams of dried yeast, and away you go.
Okay. So now, is the shaping process as easy as it sounds, or are there any special techniques that someone doing this at home should know about?
If you're trying to do something like baguettes, baguettes are probably the sort of highest expression of shaping, if you will. And I frankly don't do them very well. Somebody who can roll out long, thin, perfectly shaped baguettes and slash them and bake them in large numbers
must be French.
Has far better hand skills than I do. We do most of our breads here in what we call boules. They're basically round loaves. We bake them off at 750 grams a piece. And there's a little bit there's really no magic there. What you're trying to do is, and it's almost impossible for me to describe. It's sort of like we need YouTube. What you're trying to do is get the skin of the loaf or the surface of the loaf stretched a little bit before you turn it over into a basket and put it into, let it do its final proofing. But
and that's another one of those things that you know when you feel it. I myself have messed around with dough, and you know when it's got that skin turned over itself, sort of that like patina.
Right, right. And it, frankly, for somebody who's just doing this at home, you don't need to be that concerned about that level of niceness, if you will. If you get it shaped into a nice tight round ball that sits nicely on your countertop, and you turn it over into if you don't have proofing baskets like we do, you use like a medium sized bowl with a dish towel in it with a lot of flour on the inside so that the thing doesn't stick to it, and you flop it over into that and then cover it and let it do its final proofing.
Okay. And how, when you see those fancy loaves with like the cuts in them and the slashes in them, how does one decorate it? So say, you know, say I'm having company over and I want to look like I want to make a super professional looking loaf. How do I make those little extra?
Well, those little cuts actually have a purpose, because if you take a loaf of bread in a basket or a bowl like that and you turn it over and you dump it out onto your pizza stone and it gets into the oven and the real hot temperature in the oven, as the yeasts are going through their last final explosion of activity at that kind of temperature before they die, they're throwing off huge amounts of carbon dioxide and what have you, and the loaf will start to rise like mad. And if you don't have those cuts on the top of the loaf, it'll sort of seek the weakest place on the loaf, and you'll wind up with a blowout either on the side or up near the top. So you wind up wanting to put those cuts in, and the pattern that you choose sort of depends on what kind of aesthetics you want. In the days of community ovens, a family would build up their loaves, and they would take the raw loaves down to the community baker who owned the oven, and he would bake off their bread, and he would give them almost all of it back and keep maybe a couple loaves as his payment. But each family would have its own design that they would cut into the top of the loaf so they were identifiable. So it's sort of a matter of what you think looks good, how you, you know, you want to make a nice sort of star thing or a crosshatch or just some slashes that are parallel. But you can use like a really sharp paring knife or a razor blade. We have a double-edged razor blade here that's on the end of a piece of steel so that you don't get your thumb in the way. And you slash the tops of these things reasonably deeply. You don't want to like cut them in half, but also you don't want to just barely score the top of it. You want to make enough of a dent that when the loaf starts to expand, you you get...
it's like a valve.
Yeah, exactly what it is.
Okay. All right. So is there anything else that we should know about ingredients before we listen to some more of My Sister in 1994 and then go on to the tools?
I can't think of a thing. I'll obviously think of lots of things while we're listening to the music, but right now, no, we're good.
Okay, so we're going to hear another track by My Sister in 1994. And again, we got Ben Engeld, who is Dick's assistant in the bread making project, and two other people from Roberta's, Zach Stamler and Tom Barr, who both play in My Sister in 1994. We'll be back with Bread Making Tools with Dick.
Nurse turns off the TV. The nurse turns off the TV. She's still moving her feet below the hospital sheet. No happy ever after. Steady beat of machines. The steady beat of machines. The old man is down on his knees. He holds her hand as she breathes. Go ask him what he's after. Doctor's hands at his side. The father's hands in the air. Reads his book, says his prayer. The door frame's holding me there. Last night of a long chapter. I hear him, he's breathing loud. These shoulders, they're soldiers now. I see her, she's all around. These shoulders, they're soldiers now. Parking garage. empty parking garage. Nobody parks on the top. Clear my head, clear my thoughts. Last line of long shot. These shoulders, they're soldiers now. And I see her, she's all around. These shoulders, they're soldiers now.
And we're back here at Heritage Radio Network with the premier episode of the Heritage How To's, sponsored by TechServe. We are here with bread maverick, bread entrepreneur, bread mastermind Dick Bessie. And he just got finished telling us about what kind of ingredients we need to bake a bread on par with the bread here at Roberta's, world famous, New York Times two-star reviewed bread here at Roberta's, and we were just getting into the tools that we need. So, Dick, why don't you tell us a little bit about the kind of tools that a home bread maker would use?
Well, I think that you can obviously build as much bread as you want with almost nothing. They certainly did without precision scales and what have you for centuries. But if you want to make it easier on yourself, a scale that you can measure 1 gram at a time. We do all of our work in metric simply because dividing by 10 is a lot easier than dividing, say, by 16. And if you're going to scale the number of loaves you make on any given day from a given formula, like you want to build 12 today or 50 tomorrow or 500 the day after that, it's easier to, again, multiply by 10 than it is to multiply by 16. So we use grams out here, grams and kilograms, in terms of measuring flour, water, salt, and yeast. And I actually highly recommend that. It makes your life a lot easier. And you can go on the web and get a scale for like $40 that can measure in grams. For what most home bakers are going to do of one or two or three loaves, you're never going to build up more than a couple kilograms of dough. So something that can weigh out, say, 5 kilograms in 1 gram increments is perfect. Another thing that is really, well, almost essential for doing this kind of thing, if you want to get the kind of bread that we do with hearth breads with a wood-burning oven, a pizza stone or something like it.
What's a pizza stone?
Pizza stones, you can get square ones, you can get round ones. They're basically a piece of ceramic that's anywhere from, say, 3/8 of an inch to a half or more inches thick that you set on a low oven rack in your oven, and you heat the oven up. You preheat the oven before you put the bread in there, and a lot of what we get when we put breads in our oven with a hearth like we have at the brick hearth, the so-called oven spring, where you put the loaf on the hearth and it suddenly gets its last blast of rising, it's hard to do that without something that transfers a tremendous amount of heat into the loaf very, very quickly. setting it in a pan in an oven or just setting it on a wire rack in an oven can't possibly do that. Air inside an oven is a terrible heat transfer agent.
Conduit.
So if you have a stone, you get this heat conducted into the loaf very, very quickly. And frankly, the thicker the stone is, the more heat transfer you get, because it doesn't, the loaf won't suck all the heat out of a out of the stone if it's too, if it's thick enough. So you could go to your local discount place and get one that's like a quarter, 3/8 of an inch thick and maybe 18 inches in diameter, which is perfect for a pizza. Or you can get a stone that there's a company that is called Hearth Kit, I believe, that has a stone that's roughly 20 inches by 20 inches by almost an inch thick. That is a it's a tremendous way to do two loaves at a time. But you want to, you're going to end up preheating your oven in any case for like an hour, so that there's a lot of heat inside
with the stone inside.
With the stone inside,
at about 450.
Well, probably I'd take it up to 500, and I'd turn the temperature back down.
Okay, so how much is one of these stones going to run me?
You can, you know, the little round ones are maybe $15-$20. Okay. You can do the same thing if you go to Home Depot or someplace like that and get quarry tiles, you know, these 6-inch square things that are like a quarter of an inch thick.
Okay.
And you can lay a bunch of quarry tiles on the wire rack and just heat those up, and they're like 30 cents a throw. So if you want to do this really on the cheap, you can use the quarry tiles and get one or two loaves worth of baking out of there without any difficulty at all.
Okay, so I preheat my oven at 500 for mm-hmm. a while before I even put the pizza stone in.
Put the pizza stone in and then preheat it.
And then preheat it.
Right.
And for how long do I want to keep the stone in there, like a good hour?
Well, yeah, easily a good hour. And then when you put the loaf on, you want to turn it back down. Remember that, especially if you have a gas oven, the air temperature in there as it's reheating the oven is going to be up around 700 degrees or so. It's really, really hot. And what you're really trying to do is get a nice consistent temperature. So you want to like leave the oven on at 500 to preheat this stone and then pull it back down to 450, 425, 475. And it depends on the recipe that you're using or on your experience with that particular oven.
Okay. All right. So I got the stone in there. It's been heating for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I turned the temperature back down to 425, 450.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm at the point where I have to figure out how to get this dough on this stone without burning my hands off.
There are a couple of good ways to do that.
Okay.
When you, because not everybody's going to have a peel. If you these little paddles called peels that they use at pizza places are real good for that kind of thing. And if you've got a really big oven and you don't have a peel, you're in real trouble because you have no way of reaching the back of the oven to put the bread or the pizza or whatever down on that hearth. But if you don't have a, if you do have a peel, you can basically use flour or cornmeal or something like that on the surface of the peel. Dump the bread out on that so that it doesn't stick, and then just
once I've got it in my little round,
right, and right. Just dump it out onto the peel, and then just hold the peel in the oven and yank it back so that the loaf sets down right on top of the stone. If you don't have one of those, there are a couple of other things you can do. You can use a piece of parchment paper on a the back of a cookie sheet or something like that, and set the bread over onto the piece of parchment, and then just slide the parchment out onto the stone. The object is to not end up rolling the bread off of whatever it is that you're going to be using to carry it over to stick it in the mm-hmm. oven and have it roll off the back end of the rack.
And if it does roll off, don't go digging for it.
That's right. At least not barehanded. The so the parchment works pretty well. Or if you don't have any parchment and you want to just get a lot of flour on the back of a cookie sheet, you can slide it off that way. But the best of all possible worlds, if you're really going to start doing a lot of this, is to find a little peel, and they're available. You can get
like a little mini peel.
Yeah, and just, you know, something that's big enough, maybe 10 inches around, that you can just slip these things onto the stone with.
Right.
Another,
it adds a little more color to your dinner date too.
Absolutely. Another thing that is really useful for bread baking is an instant read thermometer, one of these little digital guys with a the battery in it. And there's a couple of things. There's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, when you are thinking that your bread is almost done, a good way to find out if it's done is to just pick up the loaf and stick the thermometer in it from one side and just take a quick look at what the temperature, the internal temperature of the bread is. It's all well and fine to say, turn the loaf over and tap it, and if it sounds hollow, then it's done. But that may not be true. In general, if you want to make sure that, like the kinds of breads that we're doing, which are primarily flour only, we don't have a lot of add-ins at the moment, they're done when they're sitting around 200 to 205 degrees. You can fool yourself into thinking that it sounds hollow when the temperature is still down in, you know, much, much lower than that. And then you'll let it cool off, cut into it, and suddenly discover that, whoops, it's still pretty raw inside, which is something that you kind of like to avoid.
How long has it been baking at this point?
That depends. And I hate to say it that way, but in an oven with a pizza stone at 450, you're probably looking at 30 to 35 minutes, maybe even more. If it's a 750 gram boule, it may take 45 minutes or longer. Here, we're baking at like 600 to 650 degrees, and those loaves take like 18 minutes.
Okay, so I'm looking at the loaf through the oven panel. All
right.
Okay, and at what point do I even know that it might even be time to check the temperature?
Well, you want it to have a nice sort of golden brown color to it. Mm-hmm. It's going to depend a lot on the oven you've got, the kind of temperatures that you're able to hold, how thick your pizza stone is. If we're baking at 650 here, by the time the breads are done, they're pretty dark, and that gives them a lot of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You can get this feeling that, my gosh, my bread's about to burn, but it probably won't, especially if you're baking at 450. And so, you know, let it get pretty dark before you start poking around in there, because when you open up the average home oven, all that, you know, the temperature is going to just fall, and you'll have to let it recover again before you're able to finish the job if you go too soon.
So what temperature do I want the middle of my loaf to be
about at? 200 degrees.
About 200.
200, 205, somewhere in there.
So I open the front. I put the thermometer in there.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's around 200 and I've got a nice sort of brown to dark brown sort of hue mm-hmm. to the crust of my loaf, it's almost ready for the plate.
I would say so. Well, it's almost ready to take out.
Okay.
Bread's kind of funny because even if you're at 200 and some degrees and you've just pulled it out of the oven, it really isn't done yet.
It's still cooking itself
inside, and you'll find it to be kind of gummy looking and kind of gummy feeling if you cut into a really hot loaf. Let it cool down to room temperature and cut it open, and the texture will be right where you want it.
So this whole thing about like bread being served warm, is that post-heated?
A lot of bread that you get in restaurants has been reheated. That is true. And, you know, it tastes good. There's no question that warm bread with butter on it has a great flavor to it. But if you yank a fresh loaf out of the oven and take it straight to the table and cut it, people are going to wonder what you've served them.
Because it's going to be a little
It's going to be a little gummy. Doughy. Yeah, it's going to be a little doughy still.
Okay. So
The other reason that you want and this is something that's a little beyond what we're talking about here. We could go to another hour and some just talking about the other things that you would wind up doing if you're trying to be really precise with a digital thermometer, because the two things that you have control over when you're doing bread are time and temperature. And if you do the proofing, the fermentation at higher temperatures, it does it much faster. If you do it at lower temperatures, it does it much more slowly. And if you're trying to bake a lot of bread consistently, you try and keep your all those things that you can control the same every time you do it. And you try and keep records so that if things change, you can always go back to your records and say, oh, well, when we did this with these temperatures and this amount of time, this is the kind of bread we got. And that way...
So you've got stats on your bread.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the the best examples of that I can think of is Acme Bread in Berkeley, who lives and dies by their statistics. They document every single, basically every single run that they do, so that they always know what they've done that's different. If something changes, they know why it's changed and how so. And that's probably a little much for somebody who's doing one or two loaves at a time, but if you sort of keep in your head what has changed or what might change as you're doing stuff in your kitchen, you'll get better and more consistent bread.
Okay. And is there anything else on the tool side before we move to techniques?
I don't think so. You really don't need a lot of tools to bake bread.
Uh-huh.
You really don't. You know, some bowls and so on, and a little plastic wrap and what have you. But for the most part, for somebody who's doing only one or two loaves at a time, you can do it by hand pretty much. You don't need a huge mixer. You know, your basic countertop stand type mixer is a nice to have, but you'll find that if you get a bowl about that size and you mix stuff by hand, you'll get a really good feeling for how the dough is behaving just by touch that you won't get by insisting that you use the mixer every time.
Okay. Well, let's go back to another track by my sister in 1994, and then let's come back with Dick to hear about techniques.
Sorry to cut in, but I'm going to take off. Just wanted to say, if you like what you heard, you can go to our MySpace, you know, myspace.com/mysister1994. And, thanks for having me here.
Thank you.
I put on my shoes in the freezing street. Inside of my car, start to drive towards the interstate. I was a tourist on her wedding day. I could have loved you. On the neon floor, we were still where we were when we met. We are now floating away over the freeway. I want to be staring out of. To the gentle beasts of breathing below a pair of coveralls. Just walking around. The diesel truck, Charlie, now he's talking to God like he's in food service. Matters, maybe it doesn't. I could care less. I could care less. Floating away over the freeway.
Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting out of two green shipping containers at the back of Roberta's Pizzeria. We're doing our premier Heritage How-To. The Heritage How-To's are going to be a guide to doing pretty much anything you want artisanally with America's leading artisans. If you want to learn how to frame your own painting, we'll have a Heritage How-To about that. Bake your own bread, make your own pizza. So we're here with Dick Bessie, the head of the bread making project here at Roberta's, and he's going to tell us a few techniques that we can use to make the bread before we put it in the oven to create the dough. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about the techniques that you that are essential to creating this bread.
There's really not a whole lot of magic that's going on with this. You're just sort of paying attention to timing and some details. When you if you're mixing bread dough, you want to sequence it like flour and water go together. If you use the autolyse we talked about at the start of the program, you'll let it sit for like a half hour or so. Put in whatever yeast or leavening you're using. If you're using a sourdough starter or whatever, then put that in, mix it all together, and then mix in the salt last. And the reason for mixing salt in last is that salt tends to, it has a bunch of interesting effects in bread. It, you know, adds flavor, of course. And
Dehydrates it, right?
Yeah, and it slows down yeast activity. So if you dump in a whole lot of salt too early, like if you were to put the flour and the water together and then throw in the salt and then throw in the yeast, the yeast would have a little harder time sort of climbing out of the hole that you just created for it, because it's going to have to work harder to do what you want it to do. So you want to mix all the yeast and so on together with the flour and water, then throw in the salt. And the again, you don't want to overmix dough. So the idea of doing it in a big bowl by hand and then doing folds as you're headed, excuse me, towards the actual baking, you know, one every hour or so. So that sort of technique holds for just about any kind of bread that you want to do. I know that before Ben had to leave, we were talking about how you would make a sourdough starter, because that gives you a lot different flavor instead of just something that has sort of a bready flavor to it. Sourdoughs give you a lot of flavor, but they take longer to do. And if you want to make a starter, there are several books that are around that tell you how to do sourdough starters. But in a nutshell, if you take a cup of flour or a few hundred grams of flour and a few hundred grams of water, about the same amount of flour and water, and then mash some organic grapes into this and cover it up, and let it sit for 3 or 4 days, and you will see it start to bubble up as the yeasts that are on the grape skins tend to start fermenting.
So this is like a make at home yeast.
Yes, and
so you're not outsourced. So say you don't want to outsource any of this process to anyone else.
No, absolutely not.
You're making your own yeast. And how long do you want to let them age? So to speak?
Well, this will sit there for 3 or 4 days, and it'll get bubbly and kind of smelly, and you'll go through a period where it's actually not going to be real pleasant to be around. But after that 3 or 4 or 5 days, then you'll be able, it'll start smelling a lot like bread, like alcohol and yeast do. And at that point you can take the grapes out, and depending on the makeup that you want for the starter. And I was telling Lorenzo during the break that at some point we're gonna post some formulas on the website, so that these percentages and so on that we're talking about seem to make a little bit more sense. What you want to do is get rid of the grapes, so that now you're working with basically the yeast and the water and the flour. And you keep building that up. You add more flour and water, and let that go for a couple of days and throw part of it away. Otherwise, if you add more flour and water to that, you're going to wind up with a swimming pool full of starter, which you don't really want. And
so I add the grapes to the original dough.
That's correct.
For a few days.
For a few days.
I see them bubble.
And, you know, let it continue to bubble like that for...
Under a saran wrap or...
Yeah, you're going to want to cover it, but loosely.
Cover it loosely. Yeah. Okay, for 4 to 5 days, then it'll start to bubble. Then I'm taking the grapes out, and I'm adding more flour and more water.
That's correct.
And how do I tell how much flour and water to add at that point?
You know, at that point, I would probably take about half of the original flour and water out, and I'd throw it away. And then I'd put in about the same amount, you know, 100 grams of water and 100 grams of flour. What you want is this sort of soupy, bubbly thing.
Before you start kneading.
Before and you're just going to stir it up and you're going to let it bubble away for, you know, a couple or three more days. And
so start to finish, this is about a 7 day loaf
at least. Yeah, well, it's not even a loaf at this point. You have a starter that you can now mix into a loaf instead of yeast. And I think that we're going to run out of time today before we get into the details of how to do that. So we'll put some of that stuff up on the site for you.
Okay, great. So I've got my techniques, I've got my tools, I've got my ingredients. Let's talk about results for a second. What kind of results can I expect, and how can I sort of tinker with these to make different flavored breads, or is that a whole long different process?
Well, if you're using just straight unbleached bread flour, the breads are going to taste very much the same from one sort of try to the next. You'll find that if you're using sourdough starters instead of yeast, you know, commercial yeast, that you'll get a lot more flavor, a lot broader kinds of different kinds of flavors, and there will be more more bite to it, a little more acid to the taste that you get. As you get more comfortable with just baking bread, period, you can start changing from 100% whole, 100% sort of unbleached white flour to some whole wheat flour and white flour, up to, you know, if you want to do 100% whole wheat flour, it's fun to try and do.
Is it going
to
behave in much the same way?
It'll behave a lot differently.
A lot differently.
It won't raise.
So that's a whole nother show.
It won't rise as high probably. It will probably take less time to ferment because there's more stuff in it for nutrients, but it just won't rise as high because all of the bran that's in the flour tend to cut up the gluten strands and it won't let it trap as much gas. You want to try rye flour, adding a little bit at a time to do that. And you know, you can add in things. If you want to make a bread for the holidays, you can use like walnuts and dried cranberries, or you can mix in some olives. Just make sure that you go through every single olive and get all the pits out, or otherwise you'll have a surprise. You can mix in roasted garlic. There's just an endless number of things that you can roll into bread doughs that add flavor and texture and character to it. So
great. And so you're going to toss a couple. We're going to toss a couple of Dick's recipes onto the website. You'll be able to link them off of the show, and you know, maybe you can pick a couple of your favorite breads, and you can also sort of give us a crystallized how-to.
Happy to do it. What I will do is probably sanitize the notes for Roberta's Bakery a little bit and then put those up, because that pretty much tells these guys start to finish how to do it.
Great.
And that'll make it, you know, if that generates lots of questions, then we can answer those offline.
Yeah. No, please call in or send questions to the Heritage Radio Network. We're looking forward to getting some customer reviews on this bread making how to. Dick, I'd like to thank you a lot for taking the time to give our listeners pretty much a start to finish on how to make bread.
My pleasure.
And again, we listened to My Sister in 1994 throughout, and that's what we're going to listen to as our outro music. And thanks for joining us on the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by TechServe. And visit us again for a lot more how-tos.
Was there more in the results section?
No.
time to stop, hoping that it's not. AK Murder, I've been going so long. AK Murder, I've been feeling weak. I've been feeling weak. I've been feeling weak. Haven't reached the peak. AK Murder, do you think it's worth it? If it isn't, what else could happen?